Welcome to the third public meeting of the Belfast Crowds at WSM. I was going to speak for about 20 minutes or so, and then it's going to be opened up the floor. A couple more main announcements afterwards. So without further ado,
okay. As we'll start off saying the obvious, WSM believes that the world can be made a better place, and that millions more than people like ourselves can do their job. And straight away that puts us into conflict with the boss, which makes us anti-capitalists. Because capitalism can never satisfy the needs of the majority. It's inevitably locked into a cycle of boom and slump. It's based on a division of society into bosses and workers, order givers and order takers. And its unwritten motto might as well be greed is good. The world we live in at the moment is capable of feeding, housing, clothing, and providing for their leisure and other needs of the world's population. Yet capitalism means that there can be a shortage of, say, good public housing while building those who are employed. It means tax reliefs for the super rich in every budget while public services like hospitals and schools get spending cuts. And that's most barbaric. It means famine in less developed countries, not because of any shortage of food, but because of a shortage of money to buy that food. Oxfam don't go around asking for donations or tins of baked beans or sliced pans. They ask for money because the food is there. It's simply that those who are hungry can't afford to buy it. And don't mention the war in Iraq, or the Congo, or Darfur, or Chechnya. So there's plenty of reasons to be against capitalism. And even there is no alternative. Capitalism is about freedom. Both freedom from want and the positive freedom, freedom to take control of our own lives. It's about production to satisfy human needs, and about people having control over decisions that are going to affect them. It's about using the world's resources in a sustainable manner for the benefit of all. It's about having complete personal freedom, where the only limit is that you don't deny the freedom of others. So if you like it, it's where socialism and freedom are two sides of the same coin. Maybe a nice idea, but how do we get from where we are now to where we'd like to be? Well, we start off on the basis that our understanding of history is that capitalism can't be just gradually reformed away to take a revolution. By revolution, we mean a massive upheaval in society which fundamentally alters the way that society operates or who is run by. It occurs when the majority want changes that their rulers are unwilling or unable to give them. History is full of revolutions. Capitalism overthrew feudalism through revolution, particularly the French Revolution. In the years since the Second World War, we've seen revolutions in countries like Iran, Nicaragua, Cuba, so on, that have had major effects on a worldwide scale. And of course, none of these have been anarchist revolutions. They all result in the substitution of one ruling class for another. They failed to bring about a class society. But that's no surprise. They weren't setting out to do that. Other ideas were the dominant ones among the people looking for change. What was missing, as we see it, was an independent working class fighting for its own class interests. Instead, working class militancy was harnessed, usually by radical nationalists, in a fight to put local interests into power. And when in power, these radical nationalists fairly quickly set about the business of putting down the working class at home and generally seeking terms of imperialism abroad. In all modern revolutionary situations, workers have thrown up their own or their own bodies, usually in the form of workers' councils. They may have gone under different names, revolutionary committees, Soviets, and Russian ones. But the essential forms remain the same, whether it was Russia in 1917, or Spain in the 30s, or Hungary in 1956, or Portugal in 1974. The problem that arose is that while you had a brief period in each of those situations for ordinary working people, we're taking control, we're building our own organs to try and run society. They didn't survive very long. Generally they're suppressed, or made subservient to the new state fairly quickly. There'll often be some resistance to this, but that resistance is brutally crushed. In Russia, the Bolshevik state apparatus crushed the Soviets and the factory committees. In Iran, more recently, the radical nationalists around Ayatollah Khomeini performed exactly the same function. Now, this could only happen, we believe, because the majority of workers accepted the legitimacy of the state, the legitimacy of a minority ruling group. That's why anarchists emphasize the politics, especially in the States, where they're trying to use this apparatus to introduce socialism. We feel that there's no more far-fetched or idealistic or utopian idea than the idea of a benevolent minority introducing socialism through the same apparatus. A successful revolution, which introduces real socialism for the first time in history, will involve a huge subjective factor. And that factor is a large proportion of working class holding hands in politics. This doesn't mean that the WSM must be the largest organization around, or even that all the activist groups together must be the largest organized faction. But it does mean that workers must see the introduction of socialism as something that's their task, and that the state, because it's an organ of minority rule, has only attempted a revolution to be able to play. Now this situation won't come about spontaneously. In the past, some people made the mistake of thinking that politics become pretty irrelevant once working people seize the factories and the office blocks and the bus depots and so on. They think the various authoritarian and reformist theories around will instantly become irrelevant. In actual fact, this is the period when politics probably become more relevant than ever before. It's a period when millions of people are looking for a political direction. In the past, revolutions have led to disaster because the ideas that led the working class, the most popular ideas, were reformist or authoritarian. So anarchist organisations must be capable of debating with and defeating such ideas, capable of showing that anarchist ideas are superior, are more useful. Now, not being psychics, we can't predict when the next opportunity for revolution will occur. And it's likely that revolution will arrive on the agenda of Ireland due to successes of revolutions elsewhere. But we do know that such opportunities will arise because they're a product of the inability of capitalism to meet the needs of the majority of people. Now is the time for us to develop and start spreading anarchist ideas. We need to build strong anarchist organisations. We need to get our ideas out to our friends, our neighbours and our work colleagues. And that's the purpose of the WSM. We're building an organisation we hope will be capable of explaining anarchist ideas and developing those ideas and learning from the struggles we're involved in. But it's not enough to simply explain ideas. Unless people feel they can do something with those ideas, they're pretty meaningless. You know, they're nice things, but they'll be regarded as impractical. Why should I bother? Come on, let's just get another point in. And it's not particularly surprising. Capitalism is ordered in such a way that we have very little direct experience of making the big decisions of exercising control over our own lives. And that gives most people a sense of powerlessness. And unlike most other forms of politics, anarchism is not about doing things for people. Its achievement requires a majority within the working class prepared to give it a go. A majority which is confident that it can take the driving seat instead of building a new type of society. To help build this confidence, we see struggles where people use direct action in pursuit of winnable goals is extremely important. Winning a pay rise through going on strike would do a lot more to boost confidence than trusting in almost endless grounds of conciliation and arbitration. Beating the water tax next year to non-payment would have a completely different effect than if it was just scrapped by the executive next week. Encouraging self-activity and self-organisation, building up confidence within their class, is just as important as explaining the ideas. So I'll just say a little bit about what's called platformism. I suppose that every sports group and bunch of people have got their own buzzwords and in-jokes and obviously a special language. And I suppose in politics things aren't much different. People do use sort of various forms of shorthand. And you'll hear said like the WSM, but there's something called platformists. Well, that doesn't mean we're pretty successful platforms or stages or anything like that. It started with the anarchist movement's experiences during the Russian Revolution and the following Civil War. One group of anarchist exiles, the Workers' Cause Group, came together in 1926 and published a short document called The Organizational Platform of the Libertarian Communists. In it, they examined why the anarchist movement failed to build on successes in Russia and Ukraine before and during the revolution there. The platform was an analysis of what the author saw as the disorganisation and ineffectiveness of the anarchist movement at the time. It was an attempt to push it in a better organised, more coherent and class struggle direction. It was a short discussion document. The author never claimed to have all the answers. missing bits. But all the answers they did come up with, we have found that they're still useful today. The four main points they emphasised in relation to building anarchist organisations were, firstly, theoretical unity, which simply means that if you don't agree with somebody, don't be in the same political organisation as them. It doesn't mean that everybody has to agree on everything, but you have to have enough common ideas and objectives to make it worthwhile to pool your efforts and try to achieve stuff. That's been a certain amount of unity about the shared goal and strategies for getting there. Let's talk about tactical unity, which essentially means that members of an organisation can struggle together as an organised force rather than just as isolated individuals. Once the strategy has been agreed after discussion, all the members then work towards trying to ensure its success. It's called collective responsibility, which means that each member takes part in the collective decision-making process. You don't leave it to just a few people, and then everybody respects the decisions that are agreed by everybody. And finally, federalism, which again essentially means that all the decisions are made by those who are going to be affected by them, as opposed to centralism, where decisions are generally made by the central committee on behalf of those who are going to be affected. Now, within this platform, for want of a better word, current within anarchism, there are organisations in many countries today, South Africa, Italy, Argentina, Canada, USA, Chile, Lebanon, Brazil, Greece, Turkey, Spain, and many others that we're in touch with. We certainly just aren't on our own here. And I suppose to finish up, so what then involved the WSM? Well, don't get any wild ideas. We're a small group on a small left in a small country. We're about 60 people with branches in Belfast, Cork, 3 in Dublin, and non-members in Derry, Devon, Kenny and Limerick. It's not much, but it's bigger than it was last year, and that was bigger than the year before. And as we get bigger, we become more visible. As we grow, we can do more. We can begin to make a difference. More importantly, we can make anarchism relevant where we are in our trade unions and in our localities. We're currently involved in campaigning work on issues like better health services, on abortion rights, organising solidarity with trade unionists in Iran, and unionising migrant workers in Ireland. Members are also involved in broader libertarian socialist initiatives like the CAS Radical Bookshop in Cork, the Revolutionary Anarcho-Feminist Group, and the grassroots gatherings. By combining our efforts in organisation, we at the moment were able to produce 1,000 copies of the Northern Workers' Solidarity and 10,000 of the Southern one every 2 months. We also do 1,000 copies of our magazine, Red and Black Revolution, twice a year. This month in the South, we're using the upcoming referendum on the Lisbon Treaty to promote the anarchist alternative. 50,000 leaflets are going through people's letterboxes and 2,000 posters up on lampposts. It's all a fairly small potato, but it's bigger than it has been before. We are making anarchism more visible, and I think we're starting the work of at least some of our neighbours and our workmates, where anarchism is seen as legitimate a set of ideas as any other, bringing air politics in from the margins.
Okay, thanks for that. For people who don't know, the WSM in Belfast has just been recently established in the last couple of months. As Alan said, we're small numbers, we're 6 or 7 members in Belfast at the minute. We're involved in local education, then solidarity, local and international issues, and we do regular sales in working class areas and also in the city centre. So anybody's interested in thinking more about us, speak to Sean back there. I love that it's Lorna. A lot of interesting points we made there, and people can come in what they think, and any points they want to raise. Okay.
Have you said about WSM based on some Belfast as a recent thing, and what there's only a few members, what sort of stuff have you been involved in? You were saying about,
well, what we do at the moment, we have a regular paper distribution in working class areas. For example, in Belfast we go and do the state called Beach Group, and we do have a regular each issue of paper. We also do install in the city centre, both in Great Victoria Street there, and also the fact that Castle Street at the same time as well. So that's all about solidarity, a protest for workers' struggle here, and also we're involved and support solidarity and workers, especially through Ireland as well. So we are small numbers, and as Alan says, it's about getting the message out and being visible. We started with 3 people in the room a couple of months ago, and now we've doubled to 6 or 7, but you know, it's an ongoing process to try to be visible, but also to try and get solidarity with people, local and international.
No, I just put a register for you then at the Zone Longer Station. So I was, but when I went around, I was turned around and said, we're not about and wouldn't give me any information. Are we're backing them as a department?
We support any workers. We support workers in struggle, obviously. You know, and the issue of the hunger strikers, the airport workers are in hunger strike, it's been on for years and years. And one of them was taken to the hospital recently, it was a hunger and thirst strike. Come off the thirst strike, we've had a hunger strike. It's an ongoing campaign around there, and solidarity support coming, and we have been around and answering the question.
Just on that, is the thirst and hunger strike not off as of yesterday?
Was it off yesterday?
The rally was called off yesterday because the United have again agreed to pay the legal fees. The other matters are for further discussion.
And they say it before.
It's only twice I thought
we're going to. Third day, no.
Anyway, I'm very open in the point silence so with this talk or any other issues.
They often have a lot of health meetings, don't they? Yeah.
Sorry?
They often have a lot of health meetings.
Well, you know, this is the first public meeting of the WSF, and hopefully we'll cancel somewhere in the year of this year and next year as well. I think it's important to have public meetings, but I think it's even important and more important to go out and actually be visible and agitate in the streets and that solidarity with people. And I think this is a way of raising the awareness that the WSM has a Belfast branch here, and we're here, and we're looking to grow and agitate in world-class areas. So I think the meetings, you know, obviously we've passed them in the months ahead, but this is our first one, you know, just to let people know that we're here and we're prepared.
I can add a bit that there. We are planning, actually, at the summer, to have a series of public meetings on one side to choose. We're going to probably invite speakers up from the South who's been involved for years in campaigning for women's rights issues and changing people's outlook in regards to women's rights issues for years. It's been a long, hard campaign. I'm sure Adam can maybe speak a little bit more on that there, because I think it's an issue here which people hide away from, but for us it's fundamental because it's about women's right to choose. It's also, if women can't choose, it's about controlling your own life, controlling your own community, your own workplace. So all these struggles are all ending, and we're looking to try and expand that in the world from there. But it's not really talking about much, and it's heading about 10.
What about some more steady direct action on that issue? I don't know if they do it, they still do it regularly, but I used to live closer to family in Holland, and any time I was walking past, it seemed like they were holding regular. On the same day, I mean, people with black and white faces up all along the street. Standing right outside the offices, almost, you know, looked like there was almost physically blocked. And I would go down and rip the posters off the public posts. To stop me, but probably if there was some kind of protest or something more. The people inside are being intimidated.
Yeah, that's just scaring people from even attempting to go down, so it is.
There is a silent majority out there, I think.
There is.
But they're ashamed to think about it because they seem to be in control of the streets.
My experience, actually, that, well, not only can I get it wrong, but my experience from once I was 11 years old was that most people passing that kind of getting away from
it. Yeah.
I don't even think it was,
there was big talk on the radios, sure it was about it this week, but there's not the big, really, is the way that technology has advanced so much that they can more or less
keep a feed of cement to the council, they're turning the argument, so they are saying that because we're going to keep them alive now, if that door is, you know what I mean, it's just turning on its head, I think, so is, you know what I mean, it's getting crazier and crazier, so is. That's just my take on it, so is, you know what I mean, I think it's just, it's like a skirt habit, you know what I mean? You know, they're trying to put people off, putting people off, so they are, so they don't even know anything about their own body anymore, you know, like that type of thing.
So, on direct action in relation to that pickup culture, there is a very sort of immediate issue with regards to the Family Planning Association, who don't want counter demonstrations for the pickup. No, that's
not what the
solution is. They think that that would escalate it and maybe actually give the, what, anti-choice people more publicity.
Yeah.
At least that was the position that they put forward at the Anarchist Book Fair last year.
Yes, yeah.
I think that has consistently been their position. It seems the group centre had that position, they didn't want to make their demonstrations.
Not even if you had to say that there was a sense of better. Schools on challenge every Saturday. So, I'm sure Alan can maybe touch upon some of that. This is the struggle of Congress getting involved in stuff.
Please just bring me back on the whole SM. I think there had been really the whole partisan issues seen with the mess at the fourth of the Pales Means, these things, for various reasons, but there had been some years back when he first came into us in August, but had been any of those friction between organising for the SM on the issue of Knesset, so much so that there was literature released on it. But I still haven't, even as a member of the SM, I never got to the bottom of what the differences were, but was that there and did that? Crossing the border, talking about the issues.
It's a good question. Like, with the WSM, like, our policies are continually evolve, and like hopefully I can keep learning and developing. Nothing is fixed in the ground. Organised had the piece of planted a few years ago, a criticism of our position on partition down to a period of struggle. Some of which was based on our custom, some of which was based on policies that we had scrapped previously, and some of which I'm not quite sure where it came from. This is a misunderstanding of stuff. I'm not sure where organised stand. I haven't seen any great detail from them, like what they think anarchists should be doing. But these are tactical questions. Like, the important thing is that what unites all anarchists is that we want a free society. We recognise that it's only going to be, you know, politically educated, aware, confident working class that can bring it about. There will be differences on how best to do things, and unlike sort of the old lefty idea of sort of you had one big party and that spoke for everybody, and it would become sort of the new government after the revolution because it had everyone's best interests at heart and then proved itself through struggle. But anarchists don't go with that, because no anarchist organization is seeking power for itself. We're seeking to help our class, as a class, to take power. So where anarchists disagree, there is no problem in going off to organizations or more and putting their ideas to the test and seeing which makes the most sense, which one works. No problem with that at all. We don't view other anarchist organizations as competitors or rivals or anything like that. It's not like some sort of business or where we're looking for market share or anything like that. And I suspect that if that debate about how best to respond to the partition question was to only start now, it would probably be quite different, because I think sort of you go back there 10, 15 years, things were a lot more emotional. There was a war going on, whether we liked it or not. People were a lot more head up about it, and maybe debate, and when people feel reach, sometimes debate isn't always the clearest. So yeah, it would be interesting to sort of maybe try to restart that debate now when, you know, maybe we're all a bit more, and we've been through sort of a decade and a half of the absence of war, which has changed things quite substantially.
So what's your position on partition?
We're completely against it. We're against, first of all, we're against borders, we're against dividing people up on artificial base, and particularly in the situation of Ireland, we recognise, like the first Connolly said, that partition would lead to a carnival of reaction on both sides of the world. And he was right, it did. We spent, like, you know, over half a century in the South being what the DUP and that quite correctly were called a priest-ridden backwards society, because that's what we had up to about the 1980s. You know, divorce was illegal, contraception was illegal, abortion was illegal. The Catholic Church, although the state pays for schools and hospitals, the Catholic Church's ownership and control of the overwhelming majority of them, which leads to even ludicrous things like female sterilisation, completely legal in the South. How many hospitals do it? One. Why one? Oh, but it's owned by Protestants. Catholic hospitals were funded completely by the state, won't even perform a legal operation. Now, that has all begun to change sort of over the last 20 years, and since massive changes. But we think that partition was never in the interest of working people. It was a divisive thing. There were economic reasons for it at the time, like with a lot of the industry being located in the northeast of the country, and tightly with industry in Glasgow, Liverpool, sort of industrial triangle, if you like, whereas the south was primarily agricultural. So northern bosses didn't want tariffs, and southern ones did. Northern bosses wanted to be part of sort of a bigger free market. Southern ones wanted a protected economy so that they could try to, not even try to develop, pretend they were trying to develop it. All that, though, I think the economic base has disappeared with the changes that we have with the EU and so on. The other thing to say about partition is that the base for partition was one of a divided working class. There was absolutely no way you could have a united working class around an ideology of unionism or loyalism, and that's what partition stood on. Essentially, if you want to take it as most crude, it's like sort of change goes south, France goes north, and the minorities in either one, well, should keep their heads down. But that has, like I say, that all has changed very, very significantly. But yeah, our objective is a borderless Ireland, and then like within a borderless world, because we're quite consciously opposed to the ideologies of loyalism and nationalism. And we see nothing good or progressive about the partition either here or anywhere else where imperialism was imposed, whether it was India or Cyprus or Korea. Nobody can name a single instance where partition has been good for anybody. It's done in the interest of the ruling class, and their interests tend to be diametrically opposed to ours.
Interesting discussion. There's a couple of points raised there about issue of abortion and partition, and there's a lot of our issues raised within Alan's talk.
So, if you mention about direct action in regards to abortion, what about general your thoughts and stuff?
Direct action to us, the idea of people collectively coming together taking action without intermediaries, is very important. It's rather than people asking somebody else to do stuff for them, which keeps out your powerlessness and dependency, it's people getting together and saying, we want A and we're prepared to do this together. Direct action can take many, many forms. The most common one is people at a local or workplace level taking immediate action to get something they want, whereas people go down and block on a road because the council won't get a congestion crossing inside the school, whereas people go down and strike in pursuit of a wage claim or against job losses or whatever. It also arises in, for instance, it was a big debate a few years ago in the anti-war movement. After big marches in London and Dublin, massive marches, huge feeling, not just in Europe, throughout the world, against the war in Iraq. But most people thought that you go out marching, you get sort of a couple of million in the streets of London, you get 100,000 in the streets of Dublin, that to the ruling class, they'd have to listen. If we live in a democracy, they'd have to pay attention. And we would have been in the small minority. Well, no, they don't have to pay attention.
It's not really how it works. And of course, people marched, and they were completely ignored by the government. So within the anti-war movement, we said, like, in the south, the key question is the one of Shannon Airport. South isn't part of NATO, the South doesn't have troops in Iraq, but what we are is the pit stop for the American planes going there. Each year over 100,000 US soldiers pass through Shannon Airport on the way to or from Iraq. Rendition flights past, you know, carrying kidnapped prisoners who'll be taken off to third countries for extreme torturing. They pass through Shannon as well. And within the anti-war movement, the more moderate or cautious or conservative elements wanted us to have petitions about this and, I don't know, hold little vigils and stuff like that. And we didn't know that the government has shown clearly it's going to ignore the popular will, so let's take some direct action. And we got together a lot of people and made a call for a march in Shannon, which would have the intention of going through the fence and out onto the apron. No, not the intention to get us to run over by fence, but because airport controls are such that if there's people on the apron, then planes aren't allowed to take off or land. And our reckoning was that if we could do this a few times, it would give heart to think of other countries as well, that this is what you can do. So just make empty appeals to the players and the bushes and so on. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the self-declared leaders of the anti-war movement turned on us, accused us of, there's all sorts of crazy stuff like, we'd be scared of going away from the anti-war movement, it would lead to civil war, there'd be loads of people dead, there was a guy coming around to the media asking, do you have fleets of ambulances on standby? And, you know, it was quite, and Sinn Féin said, oh, they couldn't go along, they'd have to disassociate themselves from, so it sounded a bit violent. No, it goes, the ultimate spin, maybe. People from the anti-war movement, like Richard Boyd Barrett, the chairman, went on the TV and radio, calling people not to take part in it, that it was a dangerous thing, it was a diversion of the usual stuff. And at the end of the day, there were several hundred of us headed down to Shannon, where we were met by several thousand cops, so like, getting through the fence wasn't really an option. But we do think that if we had been making those arguments earlier, maybe in the anti-war movement, and been able to do it on a larger scale, maybe things could have been different. Because we are pretty sure that spiritual shows, when people get a victory or two under their belt, then their confidence goes way up and they're far prepared to take on other stuff. That if we had shut down Shannon once or twice for a few hours, then that would have given people the confidence to set up. It wouldn't have been hundreds of the next time, it would be thousands, and hopefully after that, you know, significantly bigger numbers. But yeah, for us, the key thing about direct action is that it's not asking other people to make decisions for you, to do stuff for you. It's not about trusting somebody else in the right guy or the right mechanism to sort things out. But it's about ordinary people getting together and taking that action themselves. It's about us being, I suppose, moving from being the victims of history to being the makers of history.
One of my most experiences is that most people don't wake up in the morning and say, I mean, I guess they don't wake up and say, oh, direct action is the way forward. You know, what happens is, my own experience is, people go on the streets usually in marches, or they see people who are visible in marches or whatever, and then they start, you know, come to understand it, especially where they're going around, the marching doesn't achieve anything at the end of the day, because there are millions of people on the streets marching, and there's still not being listened to, then you kind of have to come to some sort of conclusion of what the next step is. In Belfast, there was forms of direct action. You know, students walked out, workers walked out, old roads were blockaded, shell garages and all were blockaded and stuff like that. So there was direct action, and more people started, it was still small numbers, more and more people started getting involved in it because they came to understand themselves. Rather than reading about it or studying, they came to their own conclusion as a political development within a movement that this is the way forward. I think it's important that when we're discussing direct action, they understand that at the same time as well. But it's another part to open up to the floor as well. So there's a lot of issues to discuss now.
I think direct action is one of the. It's, if you pay, it's a bit empowering as well. If you know, Richard Boyd Barrett, the reason, mainly the reason Richard Boyd Barrett didn't want people to go through the fence was because the SWP, which is a number of more leading people through the fence, until they get, you know, it's the difference between organizations like the SWP, they don't want to get scared, but you know, they do, ultimately, what they want to be in the very last minute, until they are big enough, as if Sarah would help, until they are big enough to lead everybody in, nothing happens if you know direct action. When you're in that state of suspension, nobody knows their own talents, nobody knows their own, they're all waiting around for the order that's going to come sometime in the future, but nobody has time to develop their own potential, nobody knows. Direct action means you're learning. We're learning on the way. I've had good mistakes and successes. We're preparing them along the way. So, you know, by the time we do reach a revolution, which is reason God, we all have experience of struggle, we all have experience of, we know what our own strengths are, our own weaknesses, we may have experience in cops, especially all that there. We know how to handle that. Because if we get, God forbid, we ever get the point of revolution, and we're waiting for it to fly fire, we're going to fire, we're going to fire, we're going to collapse. It's really anything.
I hate the way Mary Kelly got sick, but she just took it upon herself to just go and smack out the windows from them. That's the direct act. When people see things that people do and things like that, I think they start to get interested. Once they actually see action, you know what I mean? I mean, it's already talking and talking and talking, but always after, you know, you need to talk and talk and talk. Once they see action, I think that gives people a little, you know, and gives them the courage to get involved in school, you know, and help be a hell of a lot with them, because that's all I see. All I see is talk. And people want to do that. I think that the war movement, all they wanted to do was talk, you know. And then it just degenerated into nothing. They got their Vietnam War, it was anti-war, and then whenever the troops came back, it just dispersed into nothing. So, did you know, there was nothing more to do. The war was over, so they may as well just go back and do it. So it has to be a bigger objective, like anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, as you say, you know.
I think it's very important when we're talking about direct action, that we talk about direct action in relation to class and people's position in society. Direct action can't just be, you know, getting together a group of activists to fashion. Direct action has to be about people in their own communities and their own workplaces getting together and taking on the issues that affect them directly. And it has to be related to the class and class
struggle.
I think there's a danger of talking about direct action that you talk about, you know, particular groups of activists. But really, the direct action we need to be encouraging has to be based in working class communities and workplaces for it to be effective. Because that is the sort of direct action that a revolutionary movement can be built on. I'm not denigrating the sort of direct action that happened at Seminar or the attempts to get under the apron or using direct action in that way to raise that issue. But for direct action to be effective and to actually achieve concrete, real changes and improvements in people's lives, it really has to be based on class.
But there were some risk of the confidence increasing, you say. If someone's on TV is watching and there's going to be whatever being blocked in or smashed CCTV camera, whatever it is, then they can see that, well, on the state's not so all might be important, maybe I can do that too, so probably going to have a deal, I think. So is that maybe not an idea?
I'm not minimizing that. I'm saying that for people to get inspiration and feel their own strength, the direct action has to happen around issues that affect them in their day-to-day lives.
There's something just on my mind, just in general, because the conversation we had started at an organizing meeting with Jason tonight, I wanted to develop more, I thought it should have been developed more. The concept of, you know, in an anarchist society, you know, the organization of distribution of materials, maintaining that principle of non-hierarchy, yet, or, you know, obviously, our area might be rich in one form of resources, another area mightn't be, you know, and, they have something that we
need, like a bar, so
you know, we never seem to get around to discussing the mechanisms of distribution of other areas, because, you know, an army, you know, we know an army and that's going to be effective, but, you know, at what point, I remember Jason made the point that the unions in Spain had
some people, you know, had abortions in preparation for revolutionary situations and how they would go about this, you know. If you know what I'm saying, like, I find, actually find it hard to find the proper terminology for this.
I think that's sort of kind of federalist idea, a lot of the way before, just kind of rather than top down and spot up, so you get these groups, but because they've all got the same aim, hopefully, or fundamentally they'll work together and share stuff without having to, you know, say, well, you give as much of that, just give what you need and take what you need. It's not about sort of trade or something, it's about capitalism.
Yeah, the actual mechanisms of getting that wrong without falling into the same traps of the barter, as you know, you back the squirrel.
I think there's a strong history in tradition of any successful Christ revolution, not just in Spain, but even recently in Argentina, where there's the growing factory movement, and there was assembly set up in workplaces, and they decided which groups they wanted to produce, and then basically they're part of a wider federation of other factories as a factory movement. There's numerous examples of how we can just, how we want to regulate and supply and distribute goods and services. There's, and it's worked quite successfully, and at the same time though, we don't think we have a blueprint to impose by force or whatever other means, but we should be able to answer these questions and at least say this is the future that we look forward to, that we can go towards, and that's basically where ourselves and WSM can go along as well. It was just maybe talk about a bit more the approach that the WSM to our anarchist syndicalism. Being a soft spot for anarchist syndicalism itself, it's still the main card, well, still a strong card in most European copies today. The idea if you have one general union and still expresses in members of unions and Spain, for example, in France. I'd be interested to hear what would be the WSM approach to anarchist syndicalism. I still see the need of a strong revolution solution, but at the same time, a separate anarchist organisation as well. Just be interested to hear what the approach or WSM towards anarchist syndicalism.
Okay, well, anarchist syndicalism, the idea that anarchism can be best brought into being through the mechanism of a large revolutionary union. And today, historically, I suppose the best known would have been the Spanish CNT, which went well over a million members in the 1930s. Was probably the dominant group within sort of Spanish labour movement until Franco's victory, but there were also very large anarchist syndicalist unions in many other countries in the earlier years of the last century, in Argentina, in Chile, in Mexico, and in fact its influence even, if you drop the anarchism and just look at the syndicalism, the idea of one big revolutionary union, like those were the ideas that influenced maybe the earliest trade unionists, Connolly, Larkin, Partridge, so on, like the old Irish Transport General, which was now part of SIPDU, had as its badge, on its badge OBU, which is sort of one big union, the same slogan used by the industrial workers of the world in America. Today, anarchist syndicalism is still by far stronger in Spain than anywhere else, where the General Confederation of Workers, the CGT, seems to have about 75,000 members in explicitly an anarchist syndicalist union. The CNT, I'm not sure what they came on, but probably the reason why about 10,000. There are sizable enough groups in France, in Italy. Outside of that, it's hard to point to any sizable ones. I think the problem with exclusively syndicalist strategy is that if you have a militant union, if you become a revolutionary, set up a militant union, revolutionary union, and you're going out and you're doing the business and you're winning stuff and the members can feel involved. Now, But you can't be a political test for joining a union. So the more successful you are in a way, the more people will join, but not necessarily because they agree with all your ideas, but rather just because it's the best union out there. And so unless there is, and there are all these other ideas like in people's heads, you know, whether it's sort of Labour Party type ideas or DUP's ideas or Sinn Féin type ideas, you know, there's a range of ideas out there. And if they're not challenged, well then the strongest of those will become the dominant ideas. So as well as a militant trade union strategy, what's also needed is a strategy for winning the battle of ideas. Showing, like, you know, it's not just organizational methods in themselves or enough, but people consciously have to understand what anarchism is. You can't force people to be anarchist, you can't force people to be free. So people have to have a good draft of what it's about and, you know, see it as their politics, something that they're a part of, not just something that they tag along with because it's you know, it's been going so far, it's one of few, you know, good struggles. And it has been the problem with syndicalism that often it has been a victim of its own success, that the more successful it is, the bigger the influx of people who don't share the ideas of the original members. And yet, because it's a union, there's no mechanism in there like for having the political debates and saying, well, about the bigger issues, you know, what do you think, where do we go from here? But we're certainly not hostile to the anarchist syndicalists. We just believe there is also a need for a specific anarchist political psychology to go in there and engage in that battle of ideas.
Okay, any other points? Yes.
Back to unions and syndicalism, and good to protect the workers and all that and solidarity, but at the same time, they're working within the capitalist system. Fair enough, trying to protect people from its corrupt powers, but when you're working in it, you're going to get crippled by it. People dealing with the state and owners and stuff are going to, you know, they're going to end up looking after themselves more than other people. So, come down here, I'll give you this wee Bentley and you just, you know, wee protest.
That's all right, going on. So
yeah, so I think if you're working with the state, they're going to corrupt you in some way. So,
I think that's why we want to have something along the lines of, you know, we can recall anybody at any time. Anybody can be recalled, so they're not doing what the rest of the group want to be done, you know what I mean? Then they can be recalled as the rest of the group, and I think that would probably be one of the best mechanisms so to do. So it shows people can get, you know, illusions of grandeur or something like that there, you know what I mean? I would be it for something like that anyway, so.
A few years ago, I was involved in security civil service. We had a rank and file group in NIFSA, Branch 8, and my experiences in there from that rank and file group really moved me forward in my understanding of how to operate, you know, with the new stuff as well. But one of the things that I found very interesting, and it goes back to what Kieran was saying about empowerment, when you're involved in struggle, it gives empowerment, but also to the same people. And one of the things I remember, and I think I raised before, people were involved there. 5 years previous, when I was in the work there, a guy called me a nigger. And you know, a very racist person, you know what I mean? And we almost came to blows, I think we did come to blows. 5 years later, there was a struggle on in civil service, and it was Francis, most others, we had a group of rank and file workers. I recognize the committee, and we were involved in unofficial action walkers and stuff as well. But I remember one day when we were marching out the streets, Peter, a police person, tried to nab me off the street. I remember my back getting pulled one side, and then the other side, my back getting pulled back into the group of workers. And I looked behind me, and it was that guy who called me a nigger 5 years previous. And I think that when you're involved in struggle, it gives you empowerment, but it politicizes you, because at that one moment, I was in the middle, but I was no longer the problem. The problem wasn't the nigger, the problem was the state, and he was attacking me from the state. So it politicizes you as well, and I think it's an important issue. And for me, it was an important issue to understand, and I think what you were saying there, you know, just...
Yeah. Right, I think... Brevity doesn't mean to sort of defeat a proper discussion around syndicalism and anarcho-syndicalism.
I don't think the two things that IWW will be usually approach can be completed with honorable syndicalism, and particularly there are difficulties in honorable syndicalism. It's recall, you know, the people who are, you know, delegated to do anything on honorable syndicalist unions are recallable. They're accountable to the membership. Unions, quite a few unions do specifically state that they aim towards libertarian communism and expect their members to be libertarian communists. Now, at times when there are lower levels of struggle, those unions will have lower memberships. But the thing is, I think it comes back to what David says, people do get politicised themselves. You can't just say that people are politicised. And that doesn't change their ideas, you know, that whole process changes people's ideas. And of course the TUC unions, business unions, trade unions do work out dodgy deals with employers. That's why I'm not saying this at that point, which where anyone who's delegated to do anything is immediately the call. I think that this really deserves a much bigger sort of debate, possibly a meeting all on its own, to discuss. Because there are wide range of issues in there, that's speaking to us on our syndicates. But I do think there are certain tendencies that got completed in that one's argument that don't necessarily, you know, produce a coherent argument in and around issues of syndicalism and our syndicalism, which tends to caricature things.
But you expand a little more.
Expand a little.
Yes, so we don't fall into the brevity thing.
Yeah, no, I think approaches, one big union approach is sort of different and more centralist, for example, than the approach of the historic Spanish CNP, which was capitalist. It wasn't a one big union, it was a federation of industrially based unions. The IWW and other syndicalists were quite often apolitical in that they left political differences outside of the union, not the case with honorable syndicalists either. There are definite sort of ideological parameters, the likes of Spanish CNT, that doesn't really square with what you were saying. I don't see that there's a problem in the way that you outline problems with honorable syndicalism.
Well, I suppose the biggest problem that has been with anarcho syndicalism was the one time that the opportunity to reshape society was within its grasp. That was at 1936 in Spain. And there can be no denying that the CNT, the mass anarcho syndicalist union at the time, failed. Spain sort of didn't go panic. But far worse, the CNT, and not just its leadership, but clearly the majority of its membership, it was being a democratic organisation. If stuff was happening that the members were really pissed off about, they would have had the possibilities of changing. Leading members of the CNT went into government, essentially on the premise that we unite with everybody as BASTA, everybody against fascism, and to keep the Republican elements of the ruling class on board, we will essentially try to postpone the revolution. It was sort of, I can understand how people end up in that, but I think it was very poor politics. It was essentially saying that some agency other than the working class can do the business, which isn't the case. Anyway, history showed that one in Spain, they ended up with the Franco dictatorship. I think that the problem there was that while there was a lot of discussion about what an anarchist society would look like at the Saragossa Congress of the CNT just before the outbreak of the Civil War, you know, they were discussing about, you name it, like, you know, when the workers were in Spain, you know, this is what we think it looks like here, this is what we think, quite detailed, you know, in terms of the economy, culture, the health service, everything. What was missing was the discussion on how you get from A to B, that important political discussion. But there was the reckoning that when the workers have control of most of the factories and the hospitals and the schools and that the ruling class would just essentially
creep off the stage of history, and stuff just doesn't happen like that. The missing ingredient, we believe, was a large, coherent anarchist organisation able to take on that battle of ideas against the other influences within the working class, so we wouldn't make the errors of the Europe's largest anarchist movement at the time going into government with the bourgeoisie in the hope that, you know, that there's some sort of anti-fascist front and then take up the revolution afterwards. History just doesn't work like that. Now, I didn't say that people get make mistakes, people get things wrong. It's a pain, but it's part of the sort of the human experience. The important thing is when we get things wrong, it's 20% white, so we don't do it again. And I think it would be the experience of Spain in the 1930s that would have informed a lot of our ideas about syndicalism as a strategy for change in society.
Can I ask a member for the Jason Parker?
Just briefly on that. Yeah, workers and on a large percent of just organization, the other state kind of revolutionary period in history. I think it's also quite telling of the people don't tend to mention when they argue for specific political anarchist organizations that the members of the government in Spain were members of the Federation Anarchist Iberica, which regarded itself as a specific political organization, and probably regarded itself as fulfilling the same function within the CNT and in wider Spanish society, as you described for that. So that, you know, the arguments can equally be applied to specific political organization. At the end of the day, there were workers in a massive amount of syndicalist union who were faced with the prospect of fascism being victorious, and the option, the choice was put in terms of collaboration with anti-fascist forces or defeat of the revolution. It may well have been the wrong choice, but I think if you're there on the ground, you know, in a situation where you need arms and support to fight fascism and carry out a revolution, you know, people are going to make those mistakes. And I just think it's a bit bizarre that small groups of revolutionaries years later think that if they had been there, they'd have done any better. I don't think that would be the case.
Okay, so bring on back anybody else want to mention in this discussion?
Just as a quick comparison, if you just sit comparing the fact that they collaborated with the government, you could compare like the rise of the Nazis, a bit of a stretch, but the left-wing governments refused to collaborate with each other. Oh, the left-wing forces, you know, anarchists, communists, socialists, they all refused to work together, which led to the rise of the Nazis. So you could bring that in as, you know, at the time in Spain, yeah. I didn't solve it, but yeah, it was a previous example of that one for them at the time.
Okay, we've got 10 minutes left. I'll come back here and then we'll open up to you.
Okay. Well, no, we haven't invented time travel, but that's not really time travel. That's for next year. See, the MAI, the Iberian Anarchist Federation, the militant anarchist faction within the CNT, is not the sort of organisation we're talking about. It was a relatively loose organisation. It saw its job as preserving the anarchism of the CNT against like hostile attempts at takeover or influence. It did not see itself primarily as an organisation out there convincing people of anarchism. It had a protective role of its union. So it's quite different. The reality in Spain was that when the fascists rose, the army rebellion broke out, the Prime Minister in Catalonia called in the CNT officials in the city, and he said, right, the workers know that they've risen, they're fighting the army, you are now in control of Catalonia, what do you want me to do? And what did they say? Now, he said, oh no, we're not in control, we won't bring in the the progressive business parties like the Republican Party, we want to bring in the Social Democrats, and we want to bring in all sorts of other politicians who want to unite that, we call it United Act, the Fascist Community Party, government. They had decided to postpone the revolution. They, I think it was Federica and Monsaigne, one of the CNT leaders, saying, astonishingly, like when most people said, oh, well, we couldn't do that because it would be an anarchist dictatorship. But nobody was suggesting like, that the CNT as an organization take control of Catalonia. That Prime Minister was saying, the militant working class do have effective control now. You are in the driving seat. And the elected leaders of the CNT said, yeah, we don't want to be. Like, that was the first sign that things were a little bit rocky in Spain in the 30s. And as I said, people do make mistakes all the time. The important thing is to learn from them. But just on the question of sort of unity against fascism, you should always unite as many people as possible in pursuit of an agreed goal. Absolutely no problem. It would be a nonsense not to unite as many people as possible, as can't be united around a particular goal. But fighting fascism, it's the same argument that happens in Britain at the moment. How do you stop the BNP? Well, a lot of people say, well, geez, I vote for a new language to stop the BNP getting the vote. And they've got it completely wrong. Why are people turning to the BNP? The turn is they're pissed off at new language. They feel they've been left out of nobody speaking for them, and the BNP composes some sort of radical outfit, saying something different to something new. Because the British left and good anti-fascists have tied themselves so much to the anybody but the BNP that they failed to cut away the support. It supports their to feel let down by the established parties, and getting into bed with established parties won't help fight fascism. In fact, it usually has the opposite effect. It allows the BNP to say, we are the only radicals in town, we are the only people saying something different. As much unity as possible around particular issues, but to make sure that it's a real unity, it's unity that's going to deliver something. Sometimes there can be a sort of a unity for its own sake, but other people sitting down saying, will this actually deliver what we want? And I think in relation to the anti-fascist, that is a big mistake that's been made in Britain on the CPC, was it hope not hate and the relaunch work against racism? It's bringing along Labour MPs on the platform, getting Labour councils and so on. Without seeming to understand the BNP is growing because people feel let down by those Labour MPs and Labour councils.
You mentioned talking about the BNP there. There's plans of coming over here. Setting up camp. Is anybody here interested in taking direct action against them? Maybe whatever. Any plans towards that? And they're over here. They want to be putting up political candidates as well. They want to establish themselves as a party in the north.
The BNP has probably been at that for years. It can't be going on in Taiwan anymore as much as what they've been doing that for years. And Mick Griffin was speaking last year in Bangor, and it was a prayer in the room, which is good saying at least in that organization, they've been threatened by other candidates for years. As far as the speech goes, his latest gimmick was Catholic Protestant standing up against immigrants. But I think this comes to the point more where he's like, because of the fucking race and racist attacks in the north have gone on for years, like compared to the rest of the UK, where people think we care about. So it touches upon that, how can we help especially migrant workers, especially in middle Ulster, who are on the receiving end of racist attacks, and there seems to be a bit of organisation behind that. As far as ourselves go, I'm sure we would be quite keen to look into it and see as much as we can do, but we are a small group and limited resources, so we're not going to overstretch ourselves. But we have been involved in popularising in terms of pointing out who the real sponsors are. You know what I mean? It's not the people who's coming here and even search for better race conditions, it's the people on top. It's the bosses who are here, the real sponsors are. But for example, the son, Ruben Murdoch, always complains about all these sponsors coming over and taking taxes, yet he's a flogger who probably has money in Monaco.
He gets more welfare
elsewhere around Europe, and he doesn't pay a cent in tax. So it's about pointing out who's the real sponsors. But we are aware that there is a need for some type of, especially physical direct action, if we're in a position wherever that need arises. But a few years ago, I got a message that was an address from Belfast who went up to Portrush, and there was fascists who had meet up there, and they were basically prevented from doing this in that way. That was a few years ago. They are keeping their heads down in the last few years, but they do seem to be spreading up there in the centre of South Belfast. Maybe they put up a few stickers, graffiti and all, but there is a need for that physical direct action also. And also a part of the example, and the use of ideas as well, and we should make the workers most importantly.
I think the thing to be in the north, you need to go up in the north, it's just not worth the effort, you know what I mean? It's just not because it's the only event here, I don't know if they're around the week, to be honest with you, they're not because they've got the lead time over there. BMD's very deal with their own father here for years on the UBA also. I wouldn't wait, I think it was a far rather put their effort in this war, so I just have to come in and go on for spooks and Portrush.
In relation to Portrush a few years ago, that was basically what an ad hoc group, one of the name of Flashes Out Champions, that involved what members of organised somewhere around their business. People from the Bar of the Union, members of the Socialist Party, and it was a situation where, what were they called at the time? White Nationalist Party at the time, changed to the Double Turn Nationalist Alliance.
They come back to White Nationalist when they stick a shot.
Right. We knew they were going to try to put them on the streets in Portrush, so a lot of people went up, confronted them, and basically they ran away screaming. We got most of their gear off them as well.
But
I think that's something that needs to be kept an eye on, you know, and it depends on actually being able to get the information about what they're doing. It's going to be pretty hard to find out about the MP having private meetings until after the fact, but I would say, you know, there needs to be a response if fascists are actually going out and trying to leaflet on the streets. It should be met with the same sort of response. Again, you need that a wee bit of intelligence, a bit of information about that to be able to carry out that sort of action. And getting it in advance can be quite difficult sometimes.
And I think it is important issue getting intelligence and, you know, keeping an eye on what's going on in advance, you know, rather than, you know, looking for afterwards. But here we stand now, you know, at least at the MP, you know, they are microscopic at the moment, but if the students start to become visible, then obviously there has to be a little more responsibility. But, you know, it's not that desperate.
I'm just going to highlight there's a real main reason there sure is for the reason my dad who would journey to Germany to get to work. I'm sure whenever he went to the Germans or Center or something coming in here or something. I think what we should be doing is target employers that are driving the wages down. So we should be, because if you move my area, I live in a different city, there's Wade City and Longmont, and they've been fighting for years with them. But I heard recently that there's a combating team starting up in Wade City, so there is, you know what I mean? And it's the same old story, so it is the same old, you know, these immigrants are coming in. But that's why I think if you highlighted, you know, it's the employers and the Irish have been going from fucking time immemorial around the world to seek employment. So we have America, we built fucking America, so we built fucking England up, so we did exactly this. You know what? So immigration is not a problem. If you go back to Ireland, it's never. So we are all immigrants, so we're, you know what I mean? So I think that we should be targeting the workers that are trying to wage us down, rather than, you know, just to let people know, maybe give them a wee bit of that. It's just consciousness raising ideas we need to do. If I don't do that there, it's just going to go like the way England went, so the 1980s and all, it's just going to exacerbate the situation, you know, I think.
See what I'm saying around. We're providing that insane rather than visible notification of fascists on the streets to extend what you've seen as well. Have learned in the past and they've given themselves up so far to be able to respect all day. I'm not thinking of the world, probably working class states, and saying, you know, look at your horizon, look at the house, there's no job, look at those people coming in, they're living in that house, there's 10 and living in that house there, they've got a house to do the car, you go through the troubles, you go through the war, and this, but you're getting people coming, getting your jobs, getting your house. And that's the reality, and they're going door to door, and they're used to the organization. So the first phase for us should be to go to those areas. You know, I mean, get people, you know, people in those areas with good data going. One thing that I've heard is the people in the actual streets are prepared to come out and meet with their neighbours if there is fights in the streets. And that's a far better way than if, you know, people come in there. That's the station from in from the fights. But, you know, if you get people in the local areas who are prepared to go in and meet with their neighbours and say, you know, this is wrong, you know, this is the reason as to why we have the black card, this is the reason why the jobs are here, I think that's more beneficial.
I actually think the danger, and if we think that racism is going out where it's taken off a rear head, formed a party in Ireland that we can identify and go for, we're wrong. I think racism is going to become a much more ugly fashion than that. The only racism, I don't call it racism, in the community, the racists in the community, and they're not a member of any party, and they're not going to be a member of any group. What's going to rear its head is through employers using migrant workers to bring down conditions, using migrant workers to bring down wages, and that's going to be genuine racist resentment,
yeah.
Which is much more dangerous than a small party of head cases. It's going to be much more dangerous, and that's what we're going to, I mean, and you get it now, neighbours, yeah. Shopkeepers, taxpayers. Nobody's a member of nothing. They're not even identifying themselves as racists. They're testing the water, throwing things out, you know. People are testing, and it's going to be much more dangerous. And it's hard to confront it. You know what I mean? We're working in the building sites, we would be working with, say, Polish lads, just for one example. If you have three Polish lads who don't know that you need hard hats, go out from work when the beggars smash the house around, they'll go out without the hard hats, whereas the practice 2 years before has been everybody's gone out with the hard hats. They work through their lunch, there's nobody ever, you know, they work through the lunch breaks, they work through the rain, and suddenly this is now standard for everybody. And the easy option for the man on the street is they go put the poles through and out, you know, obviously the answer there is to organise it for repose, you know what I mean, WSMR. Our act wouldn't do that, I was pull a section of the paper and everything.
See, that's what I'm saying. Oh, that's what I'm getting here and doing, maybe, and that's what I'm in Cooper, literally, and people are saying, oh, I'm just going to fucking do a load of votes. And I'm going, that's not the fucking thing. Do you not know that your dad was away in Germany fucking in, doing exactly what ordinary people are doing? All they're doing is trying to earn a fucking crust. So you are, and then, if you don't go to the source of the problem, this is going to be, you know, big massive effects. It's just going to get it down. You know, we have to target the employers, so we do, because if we don't target the employers, that's in the same center, that's the way it's going to go.
Okay, of course, I have loads of interesting questions to be in for maybe a month later on with an RQ, we'll get to have a chat in the bar or whatever afterwards. Can I just
flag up as well? I forgot to mention that they're also showing a film show on Zach and Mazzetti, which touches upon that things that people have been on about the last 5 minutes in terms of the rights of immigrants and how it's relevant. 70 years on, it's a brilliant film, so I'll ask there basically that people who are going to stay in that sense. It's only on the bit, like, it's an excellent drama.
Well, it's short.
We'll have a wee break here for 15 minutes or so. It's half three now, so stick along with it at 10:02. If we don't have enough to come back, we'll stay here. There's plenty of books, information over there, plenty of free pamphlets.
You need to stop your recording thing?
What?
I know what I was going to say, Sean.